Between those two sources, research that's been done by others and research we do ourselves, we can keep to the marketing mode, but the trouble is everybody can have the same data. There's no magic in research. Everybody can do it. Therefore, the missing essential ingredient in the marketing process, in the survival, the prospering of healthcare institutions, is the relationships that are built internally and with external publics. Because until we start talking about relationships, we're only talking about numbers. We're talking about market research in its coldest, most inhuman aspect. There are 6,222 people out there that can be expected to need an appendectomy in the next 2 years or whatever. That, of course, is not caring in the sense that healthcare institutions like to talk about caring, or in the sense that I understand caring. Now, if relationships are the difference, and I doubt that many of you would disagree with that statement, how are we in healthcare settings going to start building relationships with our publics, internal and external, that will indeed deal with the real issues? It seems to me there are a number of ways. These ways are well known, but these ways maybe are not always practiced. Let's talk first about the key issue. Has your institution decided that it wants to adopt this, what we're this morning calling this marketing philosophy, this philosophy of participation? For those of you who are practitioners, it won't take much of a leap of logic to see that when I'm describing marketing in its true sense, we're really only talking about public relations, about relationships with our publics. For those of you who aren't, I'll deal with that topic in a little more detail in a few minutes. But the first question is, are our institutions ready to accept a role for employees, patients, potential patients, and other publics in the decision-making process? Are we even structured in a way to allow that to happen? How are the boards of trustees at your institution selected? Are they representative of the public, of the many voices? Oh, you mean they're all bankers and businessmen and government officials and well-known personalities? And you mean they don't really speak for Joe and Jane Sixpack out there? Well, goodness gracious. Maybe we better take a look at marketing philosophy when we set up the organization of our institution. Otherwise, if we're kind of going off here and the public is kind of going off there, maybe we'll understand that it's the same reason that the other side of the border, Ronnie Reagan, cannot understand why all the things he's doing aren't warmly embraced by all those marvelous unemployed sacrificial lambs. And you know, I said that as a joke, but I think it may be an illustration of what's happening in so many of our institutions today. When times get tough, one would expect that those of us who have management responsibilities, and by the way, I consider that every public relations practitioner has management responsibilities. So if I tend to indict some of our institutions, I'm not indicting the president or the trustees or the executive director. I am indicting all of us in management positions. But when times get tough, those of us who have management responsibilities tend to resort to executive isolation. When times get tough, instead of reaching out, we tend to kind of go in the office at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock or whenever we come in and shut the door, right? Because there's too many problems out there. We don't want to hear about them. And that's perfectly natural. I mean, you know, lest we end up in some of our psychiatric institutions, most of us, it's probably not a bad policy. The trouble is that then we risk becoming like Ronnie Reagan and sitting down there, you know, having spent $2 million buying new china and curtains and all that for the White House, and then wondering why some guy in Peoria, Illinois, whose job disappeared, is upset with him. I mean, it's true executive isolation, because here is a person who I believe, I've counseled him on a number of occasions, whom I believe truly has a feeling for people out there, but he doesn't have the marketing philosophy. He doesn't really want to hear their needs and values. He wants to perceive those for himself in isolation. So the first question that we have to ask, and I'm not going to talk any more about it because you've got to answer it, and you've got to go back home and say, hey, are we ready to be a marketing-oriented institution because we have an organizational structure and a philosophy and a mission statement that makes it clear this is what we are, that we exist to serve the public and not just in those marvelous motherhood phrases. Motherhood phrases, wow, there's a topic. I have come to believe in my practice that if you first get the literature of an institution and read it and then apply it inversely, you probably have a pretty good feel of the institution. Whenever I pick up one of these wonderful flyers that says, Jones Company is a great place to work, our most important asset, you know, is our people, I know right away, for God's sake, do not get a job at Jones Company, because probably it's just the other way around. Not always, of course. Some of us can make those statements honestly. But my point is, let's not let the motherhood statements that we, many of us who are public relations practitioners, that we author, fool us into believing that that's really the way the institution functions. Let's not become like the public relations staff at Three Mile Island. About 24 hours after that accident, I was able, in my role as editor of PR Reporter, to reach the public relations director of the company that ran Three Mile Island on the phone, and I asked him, I said, Howard, I said, what really happened? And he said, well, he said, you know, it isn't really that bad an accident, as subsequent research has proven. It isn't really that bad an accident, but he said that it's a public relations disaster. And he said the reason is, he said that I've been here for 20 years, and during all 20 of those years, at least once or twice a week, I have put out a news release or a publication or written a speech or done something that said an accident like this could not happen. And so, he said, I started believing my news releases. And when one happened, and this is actually what the guy said, he was very honest. By then, I'm sure he was in shell shock, and so he could only speak the truth that came out. He said, when it happened, he said, my staff of six and I really sat there for 24 hours looking at each other saying, this can't be happening. This isn't happening. Because you see, it made liars out of them for a 20-year period. Well, that's enough. You know what I'm saying. First, we've got to have an organization that's ready for a marketing philosophy. Now, assuming that all of us are employed by institutions that are ready for that, let me share with you some of the things that I have found that enable us to implement a marketing philosophy in a healthcare setting in a way that will really make our organizations prosper. I keep using that word prosper. And the reason is that, you know, I'm getting a little bald and paunchy, and I'm getting at that age where healthcare services may be very important to me. And so I have a sort of a bias towards seeing to it that healthcare institutions do prosper. And I hope all people would have such a bias, but unfortunately they don't. The biggest public relations marketing problem in hospitals that I find, after the question of whether or not we have a philosophy, is fractionation of the operation. Fundraising is here for those who have it. Far too many still do not really have it in the full sense that I understand it. Information services is here. Healthcare education is here. Planning is here. This must be familiar to you. A lot of you are sitting there going, yeah. Okay, well, I won't bore you with that then. You know what I'm talking about. If fractionation is the case, How can we end this fractionation? How can we achieve the number one goal of all relationship building activities, which is the principle of OCV? That's what we have to live by, and of course it simply stands for one clear voice. How can we get our institutions, how can we help our institutions to speak with one clear voice when we indeed operate in fractionated units, all with a piece of this marketing action which depends on building relationships? I suppose we could go home, you know, and hire a hitman and settle everything that way. Some new hires might be made that have the right view of things, and then we could go on from there. That's usually not considered the Canadian way, but not always. Since that won't work, I suggest that each of us here today that represents a healthcare institution might want to go back and have a very serious talk with whoever it is that makes the ultimate decisions about at least having some kind of a retreat or a convocation between these folks that share a piece of this action. And let's see if we can hammer anything out. Some of you are smiling as if you've been to these retreats. I see a guy in the back row there with a black eye. Maybe that's instructive. But you know, the funny thing is that particularly those of us who are in public relations, though we talk a lot about relationships, it seems to me that in the modern world, the last thing we ever do is to call people together face to face, sit down, and remind one another that we're all just humans and see if we can't deal with the issue. And I really don't know of any other way of dealing with that issue. But I do know this. I do know that if fractionation occurs, we are not going to speak with one clear voice. If we speak with confusing or even contradictory voices to our publics, we're not going to build relationships that are long-lasting. So in addition to having an organizational philosophy that inculcates a view of participation, which this morning we're calling marketing and which other days I call public relations, in addition to that, we also need to somehow pull together all of the elements with which we formally build relationships with our publics. That's second. The third thing, it seems to me, is that we take a solid look at this whole question of the institution itself. What is the institution? Now, those of us who practice public relations speak very arrogantly about handling the public relations for our hospital. Have you ever said that? Well, you know, you're at a cocktail party and somebody says, what do you do? You say, well, I handle the public relations down at Smith General. Well, come on, gang. I mean, do we really? Your hospital has, let's say, 200, 500, 1,000, 3,000 members of the hospital staff and family, and we're going to handle the public relationships? Not really. We may facilitate them. We may plan them. We may even train those people as to how to build public relationships. But the fact is that the relationships of any institution and its publics are not determined by the management, the trustees, the public relations staff. They are determined by each and every individual within that institution and his or her relationships with each and every individual that they come in contact with in society. In short, a huge intermeshing of people, of statements, of ideas. Now, after we reorganize to speak with one clear voice on official statements, how in God's name are we going to organize to help this whole family of people speak with one clear voice to people outside and help them to listen to people outside and feed back to us what those people are saying? Because people will tell your nurses and orderlies things they'll never tell you, as we all know to our sorrow. How do we organize that little problem? Well, I think perceptions, again, gives us at least some clue. If we realize that the perceptions of the people inside the organization are going to be the ones that they communicate to people outside the organization, then the role of public relations professionals and of managers inside the institution is clear. That the very first step before we do anything else is to make sure that everybody on the inside has the information, understands the policies, understands the mission statement, understands the philosophy. I said understands, not, well, I sent them the message, they didn't get it, that's their fault, but instead understands all of those things. If you think I am talking about a giant internal communications and relationship building job and research job, you are absolutely right. In fact, I wish for most of my clients that for the next 2 or 3 years we didn't say anything publicly. Because first I want to make sure everybody inside is thinking and saying the same thing. Now, lest you think that this is a foolishness, that after all we already have beautiful newsletters, you've seen them, you probably edit them, you read them. We have bulletin boards, and some of us even have sophisticated TV networks inside the institution. So naturally, everybody knows all of this, and everybody thinks alike, right? I mean, isn't it just natural that people come to work in the morning anxious to get at the task? But don't you? Well, if we don't, maybe there are some methods that can be employed to first recognize the fact that humans do not tiptoe in every morning dancing and saying, wow, another work day. I want to work together with my colleagues. Most of us come in and say, wah, wah, wah. We all know that, don't we? But what are we doing to deal with that fact of human nature? Notice that. That's human nature. People do not work together out of a natural disposition toward it. The natural disposition of people is to be social animals very reluctantly and not to work together unless the way is paved, unless it is made easy to work together, unless it's easy in our institutions to take risks and say what we think and contribute ideas and suggest maybe alternatives. Well, this is so important that the current president of the National School Public Relations Association in the States, who happens to be a PhD researcher before he saw the light and went into public relations practice, has done some studies wearing his former hat and has made the following conclusion. You may find this mind-boggling or whatever, but this is what Bill Bonnick has found. It's granted from the public school setting, but I have a hunch it probably applies to most of our institutions. He says, institutions and public, this is management of institutions and public relations practitioners in particular, ought to be spending their time in this way. 90% of the time ought to be geared to employees and members of the family. 90%, he says, of the time ought to be aimed at them in training, in sharing information, and in participative mechanisms of one kind or another. 7% of the time, he says, ought to be aimed at our publics in terms of research. In other words, seeking information from our publics, what do they want? And that leaves us about 3% of the time to send messages or to sell or persuade our publics. Now, when Bill first hit me with that study, I laughed and said, of course, you're crazy. And then I started looking at those numbers and applying them to a number of my clients in a lot of different sectors, including healthcare. And I have a hunch he's right on the money. Now let me tell you where he's coming from, because this may be applicable to you. I guess everybody knows that the public schools are in trouble, and you know, Johnny can't read, and he can't write, and he can't do math. Why the hell he should do math when he can buy a little pocket calculator, I've never been able to figure out, but anyway, he can't do all those things. Don't laugh. A lot of things that we do now, we're not going to do, because we're going to have keyboards that we can punch in and get that information. And I see no reason why we shouldn't use that information, but that's a perception and a bias. Because of all these factors, a study was done that tried to find out who really did the public schools in. I mean, how come they're in such trouble? You know who did them in? The teachers. That's right, the teachers. Just the way the nurses are doing us in healthcare, or the doctors, or the this group or that group. I choose nurses because I've just been through a several month long nurses strike, and I found the local nurses lovely, and the national representatives of the nursing association deserved another kind of a term, but anyway, finding out that the teachers were the ones who were running out and saying what was on their minds was a kind of a revelation to the schools. I think we in healthcare should consider that, because remember, people inside the institution have expertise by definition. Expertise has been well defined by the psychologists. Expertise consists of two ingredients. Excuse me, I'm talking about expertise and I should be talking about credibility. Credibility is what people inside the organization have when they talk to people outside. Because after all, they're there, aren't they? They work there. Credibility has two ingredients that have to go together. The first one is expertise. And the simple fact that somebody works in a healthcare setting, no matter what they do, they could be the janitor, that still gives them expertise to many members of the public. The second one is trustworthiness. People have to be seen as trustworthy. Now, let me just share with you quickly, because I think this is a key point in this whole question of how do we market the services of healthcare in the coming decades. Let me share with you the study that the National School Public Relations Association did, having discovered that people inside the organization were the ones that were destroying their public confidence. They then asked, well, who inside our institution has credibility? Who could we send out there to tell the public how it really is here and to hear their views and bring them back to us? This is what their study found. The top person in credibility within a school is the janitor. Now, here's why. The janitor, you know, is that guy, usually is a guy, who leans on the building every morning to sort of hold it up while all the kiddies come to school. They get off the bus, or somebody drives them, or they walk. You know, their job is, they're out there to see that big trucks don't run over little kids. The result of all this is that all of us grow up associating that janitor with school. And parents who drive kids to school, they associate the janitor with the school. So the janitor is the top of the hit parade in credibility in the school setting. The second person in credibility there is, well, it's the lady who dishes up the mashed potatoes at the school lunch. Because you see, she is really a great community ambassador. She only works part-time as a rule in most school systems. And then she goes back out into the community. So she's kind of the CIA inside the institution. And she comes out and says, let me tell you what's really going on, okay? And then the list gets worse. I mean, the school secretary is next. When people call the school, they hope that the principal isn't there because they really want to talk to the secretary. And Mary says, he isn't here. I can really tell you what's happening. Then next after them come teachers. And that was it. Not making the chart were principals and school board superintendents. The public just had no confidence in them at all because they were felt to be self-serving. They had something in it for them in addition to what was in it for the public. Now, I wonder what would happen If we did a survey, some market research of the public to ask them who has credibility about our healthcare institutions, I wonder who the public would consider credible, believable. It might not be exactly like that. Healthcare is a little bit more complicated subject, not much, but a little bit more complicated subject. But I have a hunch that something like that would be found. And therefore, it seems to me we have to accept this role of doing some very, very powerful education inside the institution. If we are, however, going to do those three things, if we're going to deal with our philosophy, make sure that it's a marketing philosophy, if we're going to, secondly, see to it that we have an organizational structure that lets us speak with one clear voice about that philosophy, and then thirdly, we're going to see to it that everybody in the institution is involved in the philosophy, which means a lot more than giving them one of those little statements on orientation day which says this is a philosophy, you better believe it. If we're going to do those three things, there's something else that we have to do. And I just want to speak about this for a minute, and then we'll have our coffee break. It seems to me that we have to look at this whole function of the institution in terms of something more than marketing, which is to say the services that we offer, which people really need and that fits their values. We have to look at it as something more than sales, which is to say getting them to use the proper services that we offer. It seems to me we have to look at this as a social function. That is to say, we have to look at healthcare in terms of its position in the entire society. And we have to ask ourselves some serious questions about how in our mass society today, in our era of communications and information overload, how can we now get people to really care about our institution the same way as we want to get our institution to care about people? My suggestion is that there is a whole science that tells us exactly how to do this, or at least, if not exact, points us in some profitable directions. And so, after we have our coffee break, I want to share with you what I have learned about this science of building public relationships. I think there are some keys here that we can use, whether we are practitioners or whether indeed we are in general management. And I think furthermore, and I hope I'm not being too dire with this, I have come to the personal conclusion that if we do not use these or some similar method and build relationships, that indeed healthcare as we know it and the institutions as we know it are going to be so much different that neither those who are members of those institutions nor the publics that they serve will be very well satisfied or well served. A lot of people are predicting that the changes we have seen organizationally in the last 30 years are as nothing to what we could see, if the current economic conditions continue and the public therefore makes its absolute demand. Up until now, it's been a nice pressure, but not really hardcore marching in the street demands for most institutions to change. I have a hunch that whether that prediction is true or not, and I certainly hope it isn't true, whether it is true or not, it seems to me we can take the lead in our institutions by already having relationships built with our publics so that when the chips are down, this marketing philosophy will be what saves us. And let me close this section of our time together by just giving you one example. In Washington, D.C., there's a supermarket chain called Giant. It's a pretty big chain. You know how these chains are, stores all over the place, one on every street corner. About 15 years ago, I guess it's more than that now, must be about 20 years ago, the owner of Giant, that was back in the days where one individual could still own something, didn't have to have a stock syndication, the owner of Giant, sat down and he looked at his institution societally. As a matter of fact, he had been to synagogue on a Friday, as I hear the story from him, and he said that the rabbi said something that night that really touched him about people and their work and their income and how that fits in the whole social picture. And he went back home, and for several weeks it was in his mind. He couldn't get it out, and he began wondering how the Giant supermarkets fit into society. Instead of seeing them anymore as just a place, you know, where you go to get some pork and beans, he started seeing them as part of the social fabric. And of course, as soon as he asked that question, then he had to ask other questions like, are we serving society? Are we being fair? Are people participating? Are people treating us fairly? Are we getting our fair share as well as giving our fair share, and so forth? He called in a public relations professional in that city, and he shared these thoughts with him, and the public relations professional said, let's take a look at this, and let's see how we can make Giant supermarkets really a part of the community that we serve. Truly a part. Well, in Washington, D.C. in those days, a number of blacks were moving up from the south into the city. There was great unrest about this changing process, and the core of the city had become dominated, at least demographically, statistically, by relatively recent arrivals from the South, most of whom were members of minority groups. And so it was clear to the public relations professional that the thing that Giant ought to do first was to forge a real link with those people, because they were both newcomers, needed welcoming to the community, and they were the majority of people. They were now the community. And so Giant did this. Instead of hiring a landscaper to landscape their stores, they would contract with local youth groups to do that. That's one example. They had hundreds of similar examples. They went to a complete consumerist approach. They drove the other supermarket owners wild. Marketing turns out to be a marvelous competitive tool. They drove all the other supermarket owners wild because they would actually tell what was good and what was bad about each of the products in their supermarket. If you were on a low-sodium diet and Campbell's Soup was making a soup that was high-sodium, they'd put up a sign. Campbell's wouldn't tell you, but Giant would tell you. Well, the result was inevitable. People started trusting Giant, started feeling that they were part of the Washington community. In 1967, Washington suffered a tremendous riot. The race riots there in 1967 were really one of the spectacles that one hopes never happens in any of our North American communities again. Whole areas were devastated. And the public relations consultant got a call from the president of the supermarkets, and he said, let's go take a look and see what happened to our stores, and I want you to come along because we may be interacting with some members of the community, some government officials, the media, and so forth. And they've written a sort of a scenario of what happened to them that day as they drove down some of the main streets. When they first entered the city, they got permission from the National Guard to go in because they had this interest in the supermarket. And as they drove down one of the main streets of Washington, everything was wrecked. All the store windows were broken and everything was torn out of it. And as they rounded the corner, here was the Giant supermarket, not only untouched, but with a group of members of the community standing around it with pieces of wood, ready to fend off any member that had gone a little overboard in this whole thing and was ready to go into that supermarket and smash it up. This is a true story. It's been told many times, and maybe it's a somewhat unique case, but I think it memorably makes the point of the difference between being part of your community, of having the consent of that community to be there, to be part of it, and of just existing within a community. After we take our coffee break, I want to share with you some of the science, if you will, of public relationships building that Giant and other institutions have used to forge that kind of link, because I think that's what we have to do. So now let's have our coffee.
I got a note from Judy that said that the coffee wagon was late in getting here. That was 5 minutes ago. She had phoned to make them hurry up, so it may take a few minutes before the coffee is here. At 10:45, we'd like to be back here, and if we have to keep the president of OHA waiting because the coffee's late, I guess...
Very long, or won't keep you very long. It has been the tradition, as most of you, I think, are aware, for one or other of the presidential... I'm suffering from coffee withdrawal, too, and the presidential officers of the OHA to visit each section or affiliated group sometime during their meeting just to bring greetings from the association. And I was lucky enough to get you fellows this morning, and I'm sure pleased about that. And I do bring you greetings and good wishes from the Ontario Hospital Association, from its board, from its staff, and from its member hospitals. It's just delightful to have you with us here this morning. I want to take the opportunity to congratulate you on your awards program, which encourages and rewards excellence in the field of hospital public relations. I think it's such a key, important part of our activities that we dare not lose sight of its importance. The convention's theme this year, as you all know, is the business of health, and that gives each of us an opportunity to take a look at the system and to judge for ourselves how effective and how efficient we've been in the delivery of care, and to make plans and establish programs for improvements in the future. Now, today's economic conditions and the very difficult times to which we're going and the rather gloomy predictions for the next year or so, it certainly challenges every institution to be very much aware of public relations and the skills in communicating the hospital story to the public. It's certainly of prime importance. Now, you've got a very interesting program, I know, on marketing lined up for today, and you will find it stimulating, and I'm sure you're all going to get involved, thoroughly involved in it. I hope you'll enjoy your part that you're playing in the convention and the convention itself. I hope you'll take the opportunity, too, throughout these few days to mingle with your counterparts in other hospitals, other disciplines, and share some of your problems, your successes, and your failures. We all have them, unfortunately. And sort of stimulate one another by exchange of information. Take, if you do get a chance, a few moments to go through the exhibit section. I think it's most interesting this year, and I know they would encourage you to come and have a look at their wares and all of the wonderful gym racks and what have you that they now have available to make life simpler for hospital staff and for hospital patients. I'm going to let you get right back to your program. I don't want to keep you any longer than necessary before the caffeine withdrawal gets you all snarling at one another. We'll let you get back into your program. I wish you good luck through it. I know it's going to be stimulating and certainly thought-provoking and well worth your participation. Thank you for these few moments this morning, and good luck. Thank you. Thank you, David.
One could argue, and I have often argued, that in the next decade, public relations, and I'm going to use that term now instead of marketing, because I hope you can already see that the two are virtually synonymous if one looks at marketing as more than a mechanistic thing. But just to nail that point home, let's go over that one more time. Marketing is a more mechanistic thing. It deals with the needs and values as we research them of people, how our institution might shape its organization or services to meet those needs and values, but it, by nature, dealing with masses of customer publics, has to be what I'm calling mechanistic. Public relations, on the other hand, is, if you will, the final solution to the marketing problem, because it builds human relationships into this process of offering services to a market in a way that wins the consent and loyalty of that public, so those people will indeed participate with the institution in decisions, will give it some trust and confidence, and more importantly, when the institution makes the inevitable goofs that we all will make, that public will still hang in there rather than just deserting. So I see public relationships, which are formed by public relations techniques, as the ultimate in the marketing philosophy or process. And so just for simplification, I'm going to stick with that term this half. One can argue that in the next several years, public relations is going to be more important for hospitals and probably every other institution than any single other thing that institution does. Now let me tell you why I can make that statement. And if you heard me right, I said the public relations that your healthcare institution builds are going to be more important than, for example, the quality of care in your hospital in scientific terms. That sounds revolutionary, doesn't it? What a dumb thing to say. But consider this. Let's go back to perceptions. All I know when I come to your institution is that I came in sick and hopefully I went out well. If you ask me to evaluate the care scientifically, I couldn't do it. I mean, how would I know whether I got a good appendectomy or not? The evidence is all sewn up inside anyhow. Well, I mean, isn't that correct? So my perceptions, therefore, as long as I seem to be healthy at the moment, my perceptions are of the human relationships, the public relationships that existed while I was a patient. If I never get to be a patient, my perceptions of the institution are totally based on the public relationships that the institution builds, on the public relations activities. Because if I've never been a patient, I have no way of judging. And if I have been a patient, it's really difficult for most of us, average lay persons, to pass judgment on today's highly sophisticated medical care. Therefore, I think we can make the statement, going back to perceptions as the most powerful force in the world, that public relations is where the action is. Given that kind of a situation, however, I want to just prove it with three quick war stories from my current practice with hospitals. In the southern part of the state of New Jersey, we are now deeply involved in a war between three hospitals. The war is brought about by the new competitiveness in healthcare. There is going to be room under that state's cost containment guidelines for about one surviving senior medical center, and the other two hospitals are going to have to become satellites of whatever that survivor is. How are we approaching that? Well, of course, we're approaching it in a marketing way. But what is our number one tool in this competitive situation? We are following Bill Bonnick's advice. And we are not out on the streets hawking messages and in the paper every day because we know that that's terribly ineffective. Instead, we are going to each and every volunteer and auxilian in that hospital.